Group meeting, Friday, 13th November, 1981. During the last 2 months, we have been considering the subject of meditation. At our September meeting, we considered the deep meaning of what meditation actually is. And last time, in October, we looked into the significance of some of the implications which are involved. And you may remember that we stressed the state of the psyche in order when there is the real meditative state, not what passes as meditation. What passes as meditation is more or less just musing, thinking about something. Thinking about something is, of course, a preliminary stage. That is why we considered it at all. But in the real meditative state, it is not a question of thinking about something at all. It is a case of consciousness being that to which you are paying attention. Supposing we put it this way, if you are meditating upon purity or goodness or God, if you like, or the archangels, in consciousness you actually become that which you are paying attention to. And this is the actual meditative state. It is a transcendent state altogether. One can't describe it, to tell you the truth. It is nondescript because, belonging as it does to a transcendent context, there are no words, nor are there thought forms which fit that transcendent state. But the realizing of the transcendent state can give rise to various thoughts and conceptions about the quality, about the nature, up to a point of that transcendent state. And those of you who have looked deeply into the scriptures of the world know only too well that the greatest of the scriptures, they all say, with regard to this transcendent state, it is not this, it is not that, it is not that, it is not anything that you can think about or form mental pictures about or use words about, you see. Now this is a very important point. Now that happens, as we saw last time, when the psyche is utterly purified, and it is utterly free of all the defilements of the mind and the heart, you see. And it is free of all illusions and delusions. These illusions are brought into being by ourselves because we will make pictures of it all, you see. We can't avoid it. Now the important thing is not to fight against it, just let it happen, don't cling to it, let it pass away. Because like a physical object, like a physical creature, the physical body, as we all know, dies. And in the same way, every single thought and feeling uprises and it passes away. And there is no point in clinging to it. If you cling to the thought, the idea, you have a mental fixation. And if you have a mental fixation, it doesn't allow of further growth. All that happens when somebody can present something profounder and deeper than one's own mental fixation, one just reacts with argument and trying to prove that he is wrong, which is only another way of saying, I know everything. So we have to bear all those things in mind, you see. Also, we saw that the necessary mindfulness in order to lead consciousness into the state of pure meditation, this mindfulness reveals to us just what we are, just what the world is, and our relationship with the world, and the way we picture the world, and so on. This mindfulness is really the beginning, the middle, and the end of all meditation, because in its perfection, what has happened is that the attentiveness has enabled consciousness to be that to which it is attending. The totality itself, the transcendent itself. This is the important thing. Now, since we are not at that stage ourselves, I as an ordinary man in the world cannot claim to be possessed of a psyche which is utterly pure and transparent and perfect and all the rest of it. That would be just too absurd to make such a claim. And I'm well aware of all the difficulties which arise in my own mind and heart and so forth. So, when one is at that stage, the ordinary stage of the man in the street, the ordinary human being, he must of necessity start with training himself in paying attention to some particular subject or other, a subject for meditation, which all the great religions have suggested, you see. Now, we have to bear in mind that when we pay attention to some particular subject, if there is no interruption brought about in our attention, and our mind doesn't wander, as we say, then we come to understand not only the subject to which we are paying attention, but we also come to understand to what extent we really understand what is happening in the meditation. Because in the meditation one can easily ramble on and on and on, getting nowhere, you see, and then suffering from the conflict with the passion, the desire to get somewhere. So there is only a state of conflict and of confusion, and that leads to wrong action inevitably. Not because one wants to do wrong, but one can't avoid doing the wrong thing. You see? That is the point to bear in mind. Now, let us bear in mind that we can regard the practice of meditation, at our ordinary imperfect level, we can regard it as composed of thoughts which lie within one or another category. We can postulate, quite correctly of course, postulate two categories mainly. One category is that of sense pleasures, of harming, of hurting. If we look at our life, if we look at our psychical life very carefully, observe it really critically, we will see that it is all the time concerned with something which we wish to gain, something which we wish to enjoy, and so forth, to please the various senses. If you are a musician, you are calculating, oh, now today I'll go and hear such and such an orchestra, which is a very famous orchestra and a wonderful conductor and so forth, and you're looking forward to a pleasure. If you are a good gardener, you might similarly, you know, think in terms of gardens to go to and enjoy all the time. The sense pleasure. Now, this sort of slavery to sense pleasure starts right from childhood. We can't avoid it. This we must bear in mind. And therefore there is no point in having a guilt feeling about it or a condemnatory attitude towards it. This is how it happens naturally in the beginning. Of course, the difficulty is, the trouble is rather, that so few ever leave the beginning stage. They are permanently in that state, you see. And you will notice conversation between people. Did you enjoy that? And, oh yes, I enjoyed it very much. It's all the time this satisfaction of sensuous pleasure. Not only sensual in the sexual sense, but sensuous. The pleasures of sight, of hearing, of tasting. Look, that is a very good example. Look at the amount of conversation which goes on about food and drink. Enormous amount of conversation about food and drink. Look at all the advertisements which come out. What are they about? Food and drink. And, of course, the thing to draw your eye is probably some female figure or some such thing in various stages of dress or otherwise, and so forth, to catch your attention and so forth. So you see, this utter slavery to the sensuous life. Now, we must also bear in mind that sense pleasures are unavoidable in our own life if we are sensible and approach it like sensible human beings. We have all the beauty and the charm of nature, the singing of birds, the blueness of the sky, and the rain as it falls, and everything. It's a source of great pleasure. The thing is that with those pleasures, we more or less unconsciously respond in the right way. That is to say, we don't look forward to the next thunderstorm which we are going to enjoy. It takes place, we enjoy it, and it is finished, it's gone. Then our attention is turned to something else. We are not hankering after the thing. That is the important thing. We are not attached, we are not bound, enslaved by any particular happy experience. So now those pleasures are certainly beneficial to the psychophysical organism. The brain itself, for its health, needs certain parts of it to receive these pleasurable impressions for its own health. This is a fact. There's an interesting book by Dr. I forget the initials, J.H., I think, or Campbell, Dr. Campbell. He's written a book called The Pleasure Areas of the Brain. You see, The Pleasure Areas of the Brain. And it's written by scientific man who has investigated this very carefully and its effect upon health and so forth. So we mustn't bother about that. That will inevitably come. You can't avoid the tide of happiness which is poured in by existence upon us all the time, and that tide enters through the riverbeds, shall I say, of our various senses and so forth. So that's quite a different thing. But otherwise, this passion for sense pleasures is the thing we have to beware of. And then there are the thoughts of malevolence, of ill will. There are the feelings of envy and hatred roused up by things that happen in the world, roused up by the way people behave to us, or just as they do behave. And there are so many stimuli which would rouse up thoughts which are hateful things, come under the category of hate, and also which come under the category of hurting others. You know, we say very thoughtlessly, "Oh, he ought to be shot." Yes, all right, he ought to be shot. But consider just the implications of that thought rising up in us and those words coming out of our mouths. They are not likely to produce peace and harmony in the world, are they? So that's one category: sense pleasures, harming and hurting. Under the word harming, every terrible thing that is done, cruelty and this and that, all that is included in that word harming. Some of the religions of the world emphasize only the most dramatic aspect of harming, namely to kill. Well, a murder is a very heinous offense, you see, true. Offenses against the person are very heinous indeed, and so these scriptures emphasize that. But having emphasized that, the person who belongs to that faith just thinks in terms of, "I'm not killing anybody, but in how many different ways am I harming other people and hurting them, or the animals, or the plants?" We are hurting and harming all the time, and very often in the name of progress and development and so forth. Take, for instance, mining. We are digging out the bowels of the earth all the time. Do you think that the earth doesn't suffer? It may not. But if we are sensitive enough, and if we have that power of perception, we will see that this which we do to the earth is spoiling the earth. And the earth is our mother. The earth has brought us into being through its own evolution during the last 5,000 million years, you see. And it sustains us, it nourishes us, and it takes us back without saying anything nasty to us when we are dead. Now, this is how we treat the earth. Everything in terms of exploiting the resources of the world, as we say. But this exploitation rebounds back upon us. All the terrible inventions that we have made of instruments of destruction and so forth. And when man, in his relationship with his fellow man, has gone astray, then those very things are turned back upon us, ourselves. You see? So it's like that. We have to bear all that in mind. Then the next category, would include, therefore, renunciation, thoughts and feelings of relinquishment, to relinquish anything which is harmful, which hurts, which is improper, and so forth, unmoral, and all the rest of it, you see. Renunciation, not harming, not hurting. Renunciation of every impulse, particularly, which is a self-oriented, possessive impulse. All the time, we want this, we want the, I want this, I want that, you see, and so on. And if you watch your thought process, you'll be amazed to discover that the word I occurs most frequently out of the 5 million words that one has spoken silently in one's brain during the day. You see? Now, that is why these preliminary stages of what we call meditation, meditation at our level of development, are very, very valuable, because they enable us to observe that this is what we are like. This is what we are. And if we really see, if we really see it, not just perfunctorily see it, like we say, oh, there's a lamp there. You see, I give a glance and say, oh, there's a lamp there. It's not that sort of seeing. But if I look very intently and see the whole of that lamp completely, with total attention given to it, then there is a change in my whole consciousness. And if there is a change in my whole consciousness, there is a change in the mental states, the emotions, the words I say, and my actions. Everything changes according to that change in consciousness. So whatsoever brings about that fundamental change in the deepest part of our nature, the innermost consciousness in us, that is a religious thing. That is true religion. And that transforms one's whole being without our own brains imagining what we would like to become or like to be. That will always mislead us. And that has misled people through the ages. Oh, I ought to be like this, I ought to be like that, I would like to be like this, I want to be like that, I want to do this, and so forth. And that is what ruins the person himself and his environment. So, the relinquishment and the renunciation then is a natural relinquishment and renunciation. It is not something which is forced upon one, which one forces upon oneself. Oh, I shall give up this, I'll give up smoking from next week, you see. Or as St. Augustine said, God make me chaste, but not just yet. You see. You see, it's not like that. When you really see that energy within your psyche which wants to do this or that or grab this, that or the other, that energy completely changes its mode of expression. And what is a vice is transformed into a virtue. This is how we become virtuous. We don't become virtuous by grasping at virtue and defining virtue with our imperfect psyche. See, these are the great difficulties with the old forms in which the religions of the world presented the religious life. They used phrases like fight against the evil, fight the good fight, overcome evil, and so forth. Nothing of the sort. There is no such thing as fighting and overcoming in the sense of destroying and annihilating. Because in this universe, there is no such thing as annihilation. There is only transformation which takes place all the time. You see? And this is the thing which has never been sufficiently emphasized. Partly because people have never known the scientific fact, the purely material fact, if you like, that the entire universal process is a process of transformation and transmutation, if you like. You see, that is what happens. So there is no such thing as annihilating or destroying, but there is continual changing. And if we see the thing for what it actually is, then we know in which way to change it in the right way, so that there is growth, development, fulfillment. Now these are things which are not known sufficiently well, and so people continue to make mistakes. Now, the question will arise, well, what do I do when a thought of sense pleasures arises in my mind when I'm trying to meditate? Because these are the things that will, if you want to meditate on a particular deep subject, and thoughts of sensuous delights, thoughts of malevolence or envy or anything crop up. What does one do when that happens and interferes? Don't fight against it. Recognize it. See it. This has arisen in my mind. How has it arisen? Why has it arisen? Search out the roots within one's own self. This is the important part of it all, the really important part, because that shows us what we are. And if we grow in understanding what we are, we understand the whole world, because all human beings are like that. That's the long and the short of it, you see. So we understand the world, therefore. And when, therefore, we come into contact with what we call the outside world, with other people and so forth, and we see that person behaving in a manner which is the manner I would have behaved according to that thought which arose in me, then there is no condemnation. There, but for the grace of God, goes much up. You see? It's like that. So, the result is that the reality of understanding, of compassion, and therefore also of wisdom, begins to function more and more freely within us by this sort of seeing, really seeing, and recognizing that this is what I really am. The purification takes place. Thank you. Now, when we recognize that some evil state has arisen within the psyche, you see, and we see the fact as the fact, we will see that ill state, this is the real meaning of dukkha, suffering, the ill state, evil. We will see that it conduces to harm to oneself and to others, that it obstructs insight, that it is associated with distress, because anything the ill which arises in our own psyche causes us distress. We know that this is evil, and it causes us distress. It hurts our ego. It is a great blow to our vanity. We are all filled with the vain idea, oh, I am a good fellow, I am all right, you see. And so it causes distress. And of course, it shuts the door on nirvana. Now, as we reflect on each of these aspects, the urge for the sense pleasure or for hurting or harming subsides gradually. But we have to keep looking at it without fighting with it. Keep looking at it, understand it. Because in understanding there is love. There is inclusiveness, not exclusiveness. The state of sin is the state of exclusiveness, of separateness. The state of love is the state of inclusiveness. You see? And when that is there, things are well. If we allow ourselves, now we know this, don't we? That especially where our natural urges, our natural desires are frustrated or thwarted, we tend to enjoy them in imagination. You see? In imagination. Now, if we do that, and if in imagination we allow ourselves to feel and think thoughts and feelings of ill will and envy and hurting somebody else because he's got the better of me in this, that or the other way, or he's got something which I would like to have had but couldn't get and so forth. When all that happens, if we wallow in our imagination in that direction, then the psyche tends to have a bias that way and to become worse and worse, become more vengeful, more hurtful, and more self-indulgent, you see. So that diminishes our power to remain free from evil. But if we turn our thought and our attention to the relinquishment of the ill states, all the ill states, then we get the slope is not downwards into perdition, but it helps us on to our own further growth inwardly, our own purification. That's what it comes to, you see. So when our attempt to understand the state which is free from sense desires and so forth, free from malevolence and hatred and violence and all that, when we are free that way, then we see that we have deeper insight into the fact, whatever the fact may be, whatever the situation may be, whoever the person may be, and so on. We have a deeper insight into things. And we become free from distress, our own psychological distress, and we open the door to nirvana. We open the door to the kingdom of heaven. But we mustn't try to define the kingdom of heaven. And this is where, you know, there have been peculiar mistakes made in the scriptural writings, sitting on the right hand of God the Father and angels blowing trumpets. Because one would like to know which firm supplies the angels with trumpets. Or do they make that as a free gift to the heavenly hosts? And in Islam, there are lovely fountains and houris and all sorts of sensual delights available. Well, I mean, all that is perfectly stupid, isn't it? Just altogether stupid. But there it is. So if we set about it the right way and the psyche becomes pure, we see the truth, and in a state of ease we can live the good life, in a state of ease, not with effort, not with inner conflict, but in a state of ease we can live the good life in thought and feeling, in speech and in action. Therefore, as the Buddha said in one of his discourses, make much of the thought of renunciation, of relinquishment, of non-violence, of non-harming. Now, there is the usual criticism of both Buddhism and Hinduism that it is also negative. It is non-malevolence, non-harming, non-this, non-the-other. But nothing could be more sensible than putting it in the negative form. Do I know what love really is? Do I know it? I have certain ideas about it, you see. When we ask a person, when a person says, I love you and so on, what he essentially means is that I wish to have sexual relations with you. That is his fundamental drive, his fundamental desire. Can't help that because we are an animal species and the species has to be preserved. And therefore this coming up to consciousness in the brain naturally interprets it that way. I want to possess you. I want you to do what I'd like you to do for me and be this, that and the other for me. All these perfectly idiotic ideas, we have about love. But the reality of love is something unknown. But we do know what hate is, what anger is. From our personal experience, right from childhood. See how little children, especially brothers and sisters in a family, how one will hit the other and so forth, and they'll react, you see, in terms of hate and violence and so forth. This is something we know. We know what the vicious state is. Through actual experience, we know it, you see. And therefore, this is what we can see. And if we see its viciousness and all that it does, how it produces distress, how it shuts out insight and shuts the doors of nirvana to us, or that inner peace and stability and poise and all the lovely and wonderful things which one as a human being can realize within his own mind and in his own inner life, you see. So there you have it. When one sees the evil fully and completely, the good is present. And the brain shouldn't try to define that good which is present. Spontaneously and naturally, the person will live the good life. He won't know that I am living the good life. And this is the charm of it. Does a flower, does a rose, a lovely rose which is blooming, does it know how beautiful it is, what pleasure it is giving to human beings, what a wonderful perfume emanates from it? A rose doesn't know that at all. And if a rose could speak, say, the English language or Chinese or whichever you like, somebody told the rose that, oh, you are like this, the rose would think, what's wrong with this fellow? He's off his nut. You are spontaneously something. You are naturally that. And so there is no question of argument or discussion and so forth. So now, when we attempt to meditate in our little way, bear these things in mind. You may find them quite helpful. The two categories, one of the uprising of the passion for pleasure, of thoughts of malevolence and ill will and violence and so forth, or hurting others, and the opposite category of non-malevolence, non-harming, non-hurting. And that way there will be a change and a growth of the psyche, a purification of the psyche. And then the deeper things of meditation will come through naturally. Thank you.